season. And it always rains, but now it's just become there's so many floods. There's my father's house recently, his roof completely collapsed. And this is really the impacts of climate change. It's something that we're used to seeing rain in Brazil, but not to this degree. And of course, it impacts everyone, but particularly the folks who are on the front lines, who are poor and don't necessarily have the means to rebuild their house or to have shelter.
Finally, Renata, this comes after 75,000 people marched. The focus was President Biden. Biden and fossil fuels, the banner across the stage. Why President Biden? We have 20 seconds.
Well, Biden, you know, of course, is the president of the United States, the most powerful country, is also the biggest producer of oil and gas. And Biden can stop new fossil fuel projects right now and has chosen not to do so, and has chosen actually even not to attend the climate summit and commit himself to stop.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to continue to cover the climate actions across the week. Renata Pumarol and Elise Nascimento. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with and requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in September via public video conference. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, September 7th at 5:30 p.m. and again Thursday, September 21st at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found at our website at KBOO-FM. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Stories I've Told the Stars, Friday, September 22nd, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts in Portland. Stories I've Told the Stars is a short documentary that features the stories of three men who left their homes in Ethiopia in the 80s to escape civil war. They share stories of their experiences as refugees, their journey to the United States, and their resettlement in the Pacific Northwest. Stories I've Told the Stars will show Friday, September 22nd from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pacific Northwest College of Arts, 511 Northwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Portland. That's right, KBOO Portland, where it's 8:02 a.m. It's on Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, and welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Abe Proctor, and joining me, as she does every week, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
This week, we're going to turn our gaze on to local matters, specifically the fate of ballot measure 110, which was passed by a pretty sizable majority in the election of 2020. And Measure 110, as most of you likely know, decriminalized the possession of small amounts of hard drugs and also purportedly provided resources for the treatment of people who were habitual users of hard drugs. A few years into the implementation of that measure, its results are decidedly a mixed bag, and an effort is afoot right now, backed by some of the state's wealthiest residents, to recriminalize those same small amounts of hard drugs. So here we are, Tracy, a few years into an unprecedented social experiment in the United States, not without precedent around the world, but here in the U.S. most definitely, and we seem to be at a bit of an impasse. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an effort. So there's, you know, folks who are proposing a ballot measure. So using the same, you know, electoral system to change that and take us back to the old days of, you know, criminalizing small amounts of drug use, putting people in jail for non, you know, violent crimes. Oftentimes people see as victimless crimes. They're not victimless. Of course, there's usually someone who's making lots of money on keeping people addicted, so I don't think it's victimless, but it also is, you know, when people are addicted to drugs, we have to always talk about the root causes, and I use the show to kind of illuminate some of that. But really taking us back to, you know, a la Nancy Reagan, just say no. And if you don't say no, we're going to put you in jail for it. We're going to fine you when you already don't have money. We're going to create life being even worse than it already is for you to help you get off drugs. It's never worked, right? We're 40 plus years into this kind of really shift into criminalizing drug use at a level that has exploded the prison population, has not resulted in any less drug use. Actually, there, you know, there's drugs prolific and rampant in the prison system. So it's not, it's never worked. And this effort was to try and do something different, right? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting some kind of different result. But there are people who are so committed to criminalizing anything that's relatively seen as negative for them, but it's usually criminalizing the actual people. And so if we want to talk about the people, which we will, you know, we can talk about people who are oftentimes struggling with housing insecurity, struggling with job insecurity or joblessness, struggling with food insecurity, and needing an escape, right? And the interesting thing is, you know, when we talk about the criminalization of hard drugs, it's that use in the open that oftentimes people who are very rich and live in the West Hills or wherever they live are not exposing themselves to public use and oftentimes can keep it under wraps, right? And so also, right, it's oftentimes targeted at our most vulnerable populations. And so this effort to kind of turn back the clock on criminalization is away. It's underfoot. Interestingly enough, there's also an effort to undermine the will of the voters in Oregon. There's a trial happening right now that's contesting Measure 114, which was kind of a gun control, gun sense law that was enacted our last election. And so we'll continue seeing, and it's oftentimes, you know, people who are leaning right or far right, pushing these efforts, the same kind of folks that were trying to unseat our former governor, Kate Brown, calling for a recall for Kate Brown. These folks haven't gone away, but they keep popping up in different ways to either undermine or turn back the will of the voters. We've seen in national news, a demonization of Portland and downtown Portland is the worst place ever in the world, and it's because there's so many people and blah, 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 right? This narrative has continued, and as I always talk about narrative change, we have to change the narrative around even why people are doing drugs. And Abe and I will talk a little bit about Portugal and kind of why we even got to the point where we wanted to decriminalize, because it's never worked. But it has worked in other places, and we'll talk about why it hasn't worked here.
Yeah, the irony there is pretty clear. Wealthy and conservative interests are pushing hard to recriminalize drugs and drug use in the state, and pushing hard to eliminate any restrictions on the use of something that's arguably far more dangerous to the public health, guns. So interesting juxtaposition there. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's, Tracy, look for a minute, if we could, at the substance of Measure 110. As we mentioned at the outset of the show, was a groundbreaking and unprecedented step to remove the role of law enforcement from the paradigm of drug use and abuse in the United States. advocates had long called for the decriminalization of drug use so as to remove that social pressure and stigma from people who habitually use drugs, and also to open the gates and make obtaining treatment more viable and obtainable for them. But as we mentioned, it's been a mixed bag since the passage of Measure 110. We've seen this overdose deaths in the state rise sharply. We've seen the number of adults with substance abuse disorders also rise sharply. And we have not seen the promised resources and infrastructure for treatment become available to drug users. So from that point of view, it's not surprising that moneyed interests are calling for it's not an outright repeal of Measure 110, what they're asking for, but a rollback of many of its provisions. Part of the problem here is that the Oregon Health Authority, which was charged with establishing the infrastructure and providing the resources for statewide treatment programs, has been uneven with that work and has not delivered as expected. There was even a policy change enacted in the last session of the legislature to shift that responsibility from the OHA to the State Drug and Alcohol Policy Commission. So the treatment resources and infrastructure are not there. It hasn't worked out the way I think many people who voted for the measure had hoped that it would. And right now, according to statewide polls, a pretty sizable majority now supports rolling back and undoing some of the provisions of Measure 110. As things stand now, Tracy, it's unlikely we would go all the way back to where we were before Measure 110 was passed. But certainly we would be back to criminalizing possession of things like fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamines, and so on.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, too, we also don't look at kind of the surrounding environmental causes, right? So we had, of course, the pandemic. This law was passed in 2020. The pandemic happened in 2020. We saw mass, people leaving jobs, losing jobs, all of that. We saw people desperate, destitute, just trying to struggle and survive. And so we're not also taking into account all of that happened. That also leads to this, kind of rampant drug use and a need for folks to just kind of tune out, to check out of life. We also haven't talked, and talked about the root cause of the surge in houselessness, right? Like, using drugs, especially hard drugs that, just completely, tap you out of your ability to focus or be even present in your body, right? We're talking about fentanyl, opioids, others that are pain-killing drugs, right? I say pain with air quotes because the pain is oftentimes not a physical pain. It's a psychological pain that people are trying to numb themselves from. But we're not also thinking about, well, what have we done with any of the social supports to make this effort real? And we haven't done anything. That's the reality. When it was enacted, we didn't have the structural supports within the mental and behavioral health care system, as you said, Abe. We've never had the kind of infrastructure around housing to get people housed, right? The jobs came back, but they came back for only certain people, and oftentimes the jobs that would have been available to the people we are talking about, they don't pay enough to even help someone get on their feet. So we're talking about whole systems and societal structural problems, and then saying, well, we tried it, it didn't work. It's not even been, three whole years. What are we talking about? This idea that you can make a change and see a result immediately without putting the resources behind making sure that effort is successful is very much the story of America. We like quick fixes, and these are not quick fixes. If we're going to see any meaningful change, but yet there are people who continue to profit from the prison industrial system, continue to be bothered by seeing people in destitution and despair, so let's just lock them up. Let's just move them out of our view and move on, right? no solutions in sight with any of this. And what's interesting is that the folks who are proposing this ballot initiative will tell you that the reason they don't like it is because there was not a mandate for folks who were suspected of or alleged to be using these hard drugs. There was not a mandate to get those people to make those people go to treatment. Well, the reality is you can't make people go to treatment if you can't afford to pay for them to go to treatment. Treatment is very expensive. And if you don't have enough of the resources to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to get treatment. So it was flawed from the outset. And until we understand where our priorities are with our community members and how we use resources, we're going to continue going back to this old not solution of locking people up.
Yeah, and I think you and I agree on this, Kevin. I suspect most of our listeners will as well. That the long arm of the law is not the way to reduce the burden of drug use and addiction on our society. And I say reduce the burden because that's really the approach here. Harm reduction is what we're talking about. We're not talking about a stamp it out heavy punishment model. We're not talking about the just say no Nancy Reagan model that you talked about, Tracy. We're talking about recognizing that drug use is something that happens. That human beings use drugs. Which ones they choose to use is a matter of choice. But that is never going to go away. We can look around and see the manifest harms that result from habitual drug use and abuse. And the best approach, and that was what animated the passage of Measure 110, is that harm reduction is better than criminalization, than incarceration. Helping people to get better is a better approach. And so the measure, I think, was a good idea in that respect. But again, we're seeing a situation where it didn't work out as hoped. Portugal, as I mentioned earlier in the show, was the model for the implementation of Measure 110. And a group of Oregon legislators and other policymakers, in fact, are going to be traveling to Portugal in the near future to check out what's going on there. Portugal has had a better track record of success with decriminalizing hard drugs than Oregon has, although a much larger sample size and a much longer period of time to get it right. But there are some key differences in the approaches between what's happening in Portugal and what's happening here in Oregon. Portugal has decidedly made it a community problem. Their decriminalization program created indoor drug using spaces where drug users were invited to these spaces with the community recognizing that these are members of the community who are using these drugs. We will create a safe place for them to do that. We will give them the clean paraphernalia that they use to reduce the spread of infectious disease. We will make treatment readily available to them. There are vans that travel throughout Portuguese neighborhoods and provide methadone to opioid users. And most importantly, the difference between what's happening in Portugal and what's happening here in Oregon is Portugal has universal health care. There is a system in place to fill in the gaps that is not addressed here in Oregon, not by Measure 110 and not by any other attempt we have made to provide health care to our residents. So there are some very, very key differences. And this is yet another example, Tracy, where the presence of universal health care would go so far towards addressing not just this immediate need, but its underlying causes and the underlying causes of so many other social pathologies in our society. We need it. We need it in a big way here, universal health care.
I mean, I can't understate, like, how we don't have a social safety net. We just say, oh, we're just going to decriminalize this, and then we don't give it enough time, and we put no resources behind it, and then wonder why it's failing. Yeah, you can decriminalize drugs. What's interesting is also this idea that, like, the actual drug users got wind that, you know, it was now legal and just were like, let's go wild. I mean, do we really believe that? I don't believe that. I do not believe that. I believe that people are in despair. And when desperation goes up, the need and want to just completely put oneself out of the equation, whether that's being completely, you know, incapacitatedly high, whether that's, you know, being drunk, whatever, right? Those desires go up to not be present in the world, Right. And of course, we've seen a great amount of despair happening. Right. There's this inflation that's crippling people, especially the middle and lower classes. There's still, you know, people are underemployed, right? People got their jobs back, but oftentimes they're not 40 hours a week. And we've talked about wage stagnation on this program several times. You know, we can continue to talk about just the way in which even the criminalization system has a greater impact on poor people with fines and, you know, pushing people out of the spaces that they're in and putting people in jail and the bail system. I mean, we can go on and on and on. We know it doesn't work, but yet people would rather jump back to the easy quick fix, mm-hmm. right? The thing that is easy for us as a society rather than investing in our community members. And I'm going to say it, I will continue to say it, the reason we don't have nice things in this country is because of racism and classism. And as long as we continue on this track, right, we will see the criminalization efforts continue to burden people who have been racialized and people who have been under-resourced their whole existence on this earth.
Yeah, that's absolutely spot on. One of the reasons, and let's look again at Portugal, I think this is a helpful example in this context. One of the reasons they've had success in their model of hard drug decriminalization is that they have entered into the project as a community, and as a community, they have provided the resources and the opportunities that people need to get better. I'll give you an example. Here in Oregon, if you're caught using hard drugs, you are written a $100 citation that's not a criminal penalty, and drug users are expected to either pay or they're expected to pay the fine and to call a hotline to be assessed for treatment. Not a lot of people are doing that. In Portugal, if you're discovered to be a hard drug user, you appear before a civil commission that determines, this is a commission made up of your peers, that determines whether you need treatment or that your behavior is such that you need to pay a civil penalty. This is the whole community buying into the whole community's health and providing the resources of the whole community to reduce the harm caused by this kind of behavior. It's a fundamentally different approach than what we've done here. And you're spot on, Tracy, when you characterize that as Americans wanting a quick fix. And for a long time, that was to swing the hammer and throw people behind bars. And we know now after 40 years, it only took us 40 years to figure out that that's not an acceptable solution. So I would really like us to stick with this attempt here in Oregon a little bit longer before we rewind it. And maybe, here's a shocking concept, maybe provide this attempt with the resources and wraparound support that it needs to be successful. That's, I think, where I'm coming from on this. 503-231-8187. Do you have any for the phones, Tracy?
No, I would just say that, you know, every conceivable measure of gauging the effectiveness of the war on drugs has ruled it a failure. We have the data, right? But we continue to just fall on this same way of dealing with things without even recognizing what a ridiculous effort it is. And once again, right, I think it's the quick fix and the ease of just putting people in jail, locking them away, then you don't have to see them. Then they're out of, you know, your sight and out of your way to continue, you know, engaging in your capitalistic endeavors without care for the community. And once again, right, we won't get to community care until we recognize that every person has value, and not in some nasty social stratification type of way, but in a, they're a beautiful human. And they deserve an opportunity, and they deserve the resources that they need to live a healthy life. But yeah, if we don't think that about people at the fundamental level, we will not want to put resources behind them. I mean, I think about even the social safety nets as they have existed in the past, right? If you were on unemployment, guess what? You were going to be drug tested. If you were, you know, wanting to take part of a TANF or some kind of social support and resources, people said, well, you know, we can't give them cash because they're just going to buy drugs with it, right? I mean, these are basic necessities that we were trying to provide to this person, a livable wage and a job, some resources to maybe feed your family, your children, and we still questioned whether or not people would use the resources to purchase drugs. I mean, it's always been a conversation. We can go back to the welfare queen's days of, you know, characterizing black women specifically as crack whores and crack mothers to justify why we didn't give them resources. Right? I mean, this is a long story of the United States. And once again, it ties back into racism and classism. And as long as those two things are present in our society, we will not do the right thing and see each other as valuable members of our community that we should be helping.
Yeah, I think that a perfect example of what you're talking about is the disparity that existed in sentencing between users of crack cocaine and users of powder cocaine. It's essentially the same drug. It's cocaine. It's just packaged in a different form. But crack cocaine was largely used by poorer people, whereas powder cocaine was an elite drug, a drug used by the middle and upper class. And the disparities in sentencing for those for a long, long time was stark. If you were caught using crack, you were going to be put away for a long time. The penalties for the use even of the same amount of powder cocaine was much milder, a clear racial disparity in sentencing for the use of the very same sort of drug. And that disparity stuck around until it was removed by Obama by executive order. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct, Tracy, when you say racialization is at the root of this problem and the disparity of how we approach people with substance abuse problems. I mean, how much easier is it for somebody from a middle-class or wealthy family to go into residential treatment if that's what they need? The resources are there, either from within the family or from the community. Much different situation when you're a poorer person. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Santiago. Good morning.
Good morning. I think, you know, the one thing that's really important to understand is that, you know, voting under capitalism is just political consumerism. Mostly, I mean, the big reason is because Democrats and Republicans have the same corporate backers. So as long as that is in place, there will never be a solution to these social ills that will come simply from voting. You know, they
let me
you
push
know,
back. Wait, hang on. Let me push back. Let me push back on that for just a moment. That Measure 110 was passed in Oregon by a large majority of voters in a state that's overwhelmingly Democratic. Whether that's code for overwhelmingly liberal is a matter of some dispute, but it's shorthand for that. So wouldn't that on its face be evidence against what you're claiming right now?
No, because simply because of the fact that it's what the people want, but it's not what the politicians want. Basically what you're seeing is you're seeing politicians acquiesce only slightly to a demand of the people, but they have no plans to actually follow through with it. Because the thing is if you legalize the drugs, the understanding is that the legalizing of the drugs is going to come with some sort of other social safety net. So if you don't provide those other safety nets, it's essentially like emancipation. It was freedom to starve. It was freedom to freeze in the cold. You know, so you're not really, it's like Malcolm X said, if you pull the knife out 6 inches, that's not progress. If you pull the knife all the way out, that's not progress. The progress comes when you start healing the wounds. All they did was pull the knife out slightly. They have, the politicians have no plan to, because, I mean, ultimately, people on drugs are a huge boon to the capitalist industry, because they on the streets they're worth nothing, but as surplus labor inside of prisons, you're talking $50,000 to $60,000 per person who's getting paid less than a dollar a day. And on top of that, some of the biggest companies in Oregon use prison labor, which is like 70% recidivism. So you're talking about like Whole Foods, OHSU. There's a lot of Oregon companies that use prison labor. They have no plans to actually fix the problem. It's a solution without a solution, essentially. But I mean, you know, Tracy was saying, you know, as long as racism and classism are prevalent, you know, these things aren't going to solve. Well, racism and classism are part and parcel of the capitalist system. It's how it functions. So if you're attacking capital, if you're attacking racism and classism, then we have to start talking. I mean, if you're really serious about it, then the only road is to start educating people and organizing and agitating in a revolutionary direction. Because I mean, we've seen I mean, civil rights is a great example. Civil rights was just a, was the civil rights that we had were given at, in context, were given as a way to quell 100 days of rioting after King's assassination, you know? But I mean, but you look at it like within 15, like within, you know, from between King's assassination and the election of Reagan, I mean, even just in that time, they had already started pushing back, but Reagan was the main person who pushed back against it and got, and not only destroyed a lot of the gains of the civil rights movement, but even the New Deal. So, I mean, ultimately, this is a concession on the part of the capitalist class. But unless we're going to really talk about fundamental change, you can't do that without, without revolution, without changing the system. And I mean, I know how you feel about that. I know how you feel about that word, but I think that's important, important for people to realize, not just the black and brown listeners who listen to this show, but the white, the, you know, the white listeners too, because a lot of this stuff is just feel good politics. It makes people feel good for going out and placing a vote. But ultimately there has to be some give. I mean, the same people who might have voted for this might also feel some kind of way about having poor people living in their backyard, the NIMBY folks. You know, you can't have change without giving up something, without really giving up something. And there's nothing
okay.
to, I mean...
Okay, I think we'll leave it there so we can give some others a chance. Tracy, your thoughts?
I mean, I don't disagree. I feel like, yes, the reality is, yes, racism and classism fuel capitalism. That is the design. I've always struggled to figure out how to address that bigger structure without addressing these fundamental structures that prop up capitalism, right? Like, I don't know that you can't have a system where people are rewarded for their work, where money flows, you know, not up to the top, but, you know, all around, right, where resources flow and resources are put back into a social safety net. So I am not a complete anti-capitalist. And, however, I recognize that in this particular country, the extreme form of capitalism and the extreme form of capitalism that is based on race and class continues to be a problem for us, right? There are other countries that are capitalist-based that care for their citizens in a different way. And it is because racism and classism were not the original component to create those societies. The same thing, I mean, even when we talk, and oftentimes those countries that I'm referring to are more homogeneous because America, you know, as a country where a lot of people have come here, a lot of people were stolen and brought here, a lot of people who are already here were killed to take the land, right? That whole story plays into our extreme form of capitalism. And until the market no longer has the opportunity to decide about basic needs, housing, food, you know, whether or not a person gets health care or not, right? As long as capitalism, you know, creates the market demand and sets prices for those basic things, we will see our country continue to struggle. And that, you know, that is prevalent and present here in Portland as a microcosm of that whole world.
So help us connect the dots here a little bit, Tracy. As we mentioned, some of the state's wealthiest residents are backing this effort to repeal parts or roll back parts of Measure 110. They include Columbia Sportswear CEO Tim Boyle, Nike founder Phil Knight, real estate mogul Jordan Schnitzer. The list goes on and on. Why these folks, and why are they putting up their money to do this?
Well, I'm just going to wonder how many of them actually do drugs. I'm not going to say it, but or, you know people in their community or, you know, their social circle, neither here nor there. They are, of course, wanting to address what they are seeing as a proliferation of crime related to drug use. And, right, we talked last week about, you know, the shoplifting lies that folks tell. And, of course, it's having an impact on the revenues of these big corporations.
right? If you have people who don't have their basic needs met, and then they're, you know, hanging out outside of your organization, making it look bad, if it's, you know, the narrative of the downtown is unbearable and dangerous and unlivable, right? And your business is located downtown, right? We talk about the main Nike store in Portland is downtown. The main Columbia sportswear store is downtown, right? We're talking about people protecting their own interests by removing the people who are creating a public eyesore for them to be able to make more money. That's really all it is.
So it's of a piece with the effort, for example, to push houselessness and houseless people out of sight, not to address the root cause of the problem, but to Absolutely. Make sure that it doesn't block up the view of our lovely downtown.
Yeah, that's really what it is.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. So we have here's this effort afoot. We're talking about backed by some of the wealthiest Portlanders, the wealthiest people in the state, to roll these things back. Tracy, you talked also about a parallel effort to repeal the gun control measure that passed in the last election. What can you tell us about that?
Okay, so there's a trial going on, and that trial is basically saying that it is unfair and unjust for gun sellers in the state of Oregon, because it requires things like mandatory background checks and kind of steps up the state's effort around gun control, and they're basically saying that they're going to lose money on it, and it doesn't necessarily, quote-unquote, make things safer. So basically, there was as soon as that went into place, there were efforts at the judicial level to block that from going into effect. And so that's exactly what it is. The people who are making money, so it's been tied up in the federal and state court since November 2022. It requires people to undergo a criminal background check and complete a gun safety training course to obtain a permit to buy a gun. This, of course, incites fear in the people who sell guns willy-nilly because they're not going to have be able to move as many units. Now, if they were smart, they would start a business to create that gun safety training course, right? Wouldn't you think that's what they would do to try and recoup their money? Because if everyone's going to have to go through this gun safety training course, you get money on the back end because of the bill. But they don't want to do that. And they've seen other states like Florida and Texas and, you know, several others who have just said, nope, guns, if you want a gun, just have it. No background checks, no nothing. And so these people are eyeing that ability to create capital and wondering, well, why can't I make money like that? And, of course, Oregon is trying to do a better job on part of its citizens to protect our health and safety. And the people who voted for that saw that as a positive thing, but the gun owners and gun sellers, it's mostly gun sellers who, once again, as long as we have a capitalist-based system that does not actually care for the people, the money will always supersede the will and the desire of those people.
And so I'm just chuckling, sorry, because what I'm going to say is dovetails so closely with larger trends we've been following on this program for a long time, and that is the willingness of a certain portion of the electorate, and I think I've said that phrase enough that people know who I'm talking about, to countermand and repeal pieces of legislation or court rulings or whatever it happens to be that they don't agree with. And here's what I mean. Unlike Measure 110, the drug criminalization measure, which passed with a sizable majority of the vote, this measure, Measure 114, passed in November of last year with just a bare majority, 50.6% of the vote. The greatest support for the measure came right here in Multnomah County, but there were several rural counties who voted almost 3-1 against this measure. So as you mentioned, Tracy, as soon as this measure was passed, the legal efforts to block its implementation began. It is still held up in court, and as you mentioned, it's going to trial here very soon. There are folks in this country. They are mostly white. They are mostly conservative. They are mostly Christian. will go to almost any length on a list of issues to make sure that things are the way that they want them to be. They include things like gun control, as we're talking about here. They include things like making sure the wrong people are not able to vote. They include things like making sure women do not have autonomy over their own bodies. Time and time again, we have seen this group of this portion of the electorate moved to deny the law in order that their values might be expressed in the community and expressed in the law. It's disturbing, Tracy, and it makes you wonder why these people are digging in quite this hard. Let's look at Measure 114. This contains some of the mildest measures that gun control advocates have been advocating for years and years and years. The mildest sort of measures. It bans the purchase of magazines that can carry more than 10 rounds of ammunition. It requires a permit before you can get a firearm. Permits require an applicant to complete a safety class and a federal background check, as you mentioned. These are the bare minimum measures to stop the proliferation of guns and gun violence in the country. And our voters in Oregon, even when passed by public mandate, is this section of the electorate willing to accept it? No, they are not. What do you think's going on here?
Well, do you really want to know?
I do. Yeah. I really want to know.
It's people who are making money off selling the guns, right? So they're
I think it's more than that. But go ahead.
Well, that's who's leading this effort. And it's being backed by the people who fear. They are living in fear, watching Fox News and hearing about the gun violence and downtown Portland is a hellhole and all of these things. So they are, like, literally living in fear. And guns feel like safety to them. That's what they've learned their whole lives. That's what's been passed down from one generation to the next. And if you think about the history of Oregon and the trailblazing nature, right, to blaze a trail, you had to have a gun. You had to kill other people. You had to infect other people and move them out of your way to clear the land for yourself. And when we think about colonial settlerism and that mentality, that is very, very well alive in this state. And so when you even see the people who are backing, the very rich people who want to sell us all guns without a background check, without training, without the basic necessity to know that we're going to use that gun responsibly, right? Those people are more worried about their own selves, having the access to a gun and not having to do all of those different steps to get them. The more guns you have, the safer you are. That's the mentality. And so as long as that mentality is prevalent in people's minds and their cultures and the way that they embody themselves as part of a society that is very much interdependent on each other and requiring trust and a sense that we can be safe together, as long as they are resistant to that kind of society that we should be living in and we should be able to exist and enjoy, they will continue to want access to guns as the only way to stay safe.
Yes, I absolutely agree with all of that. But I go one step further. Throw in the classism and racism, yes. I would go one step further and say that it is an attempt to regulate the proliferation of guns and stop the spread of gun violence is interpreted by this same section of the electorate as an attempt to undermine the traditional hegemony of people who are white, Christian, and male. And guns and violence, expressly violence, has been the linchpin around which that hegemony pivots. If you take away this population's ability to do violence on its fellow citizens, you take away the basis of its historical power. Now, I think that position falls apart under the briefest of rational analyses. Of course, that's a bunch of nonsense. Taking away semi-automatic weapons and large capacity magazines and requiring permits and safety courses is not going to tear down the hegemony of white Christian guys. They feel that hegemony slipping away, but it's not because of the guns. This is just nonsense. It's the attempt to hold on to a position of supremacy in our society and to hold on to a vision and an articulation of masculinity, which they feel is under assault. And guns are intimately tied up in that whole projection of masculinity and of dominance. And that explains Donald Trump. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Corey. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. I was going to hit back, talk about the unhoused individuals discussion. I used to work at Transitions Projects when I lived in Portland. I just left Portland, and I think one of the biggest things that I'm a proponent of is the housing first model. And here's the main reason. I think that for me, when I was a case manager, part of my job was to work with individuals. But if I knew where they were located, it was much easier for me to get them services, as opposed to when they were unhoused and having to hunt from them, have you seen so-and-so today, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I think that, and this might upset Santiago, but the point is that I know when I worked with individuals in Portland and I was able to get them work, even though I'm kind of against it, but I understand there is a sense of pride when a person, especially the individuals that I used to work with in Portland, because many of them, they just didn't choose to be unhoused. Something happened. Being unhoused is living in a state of trauma. So when they were unhoused and something traumatic happened, or they grew up in a traumatic situation, okay, now you're unhoused, now you're using, you know, substances, et cetera, et cetera. Let's try to rehumanize you. And that was the process, and that's why I was for the housing first model, because, okay, at least I know where you're at, and I can try to get you mental health services. And if I can get you work, there is a sense of pride, and I still know an individual that works at a grocery store in downtown Portland. I'm not going to say where, but I remember when I first met them at Bud Clark Commons, and I got a chance to see them a couple weeks ago when I was in Portland, and this man hugged the hell out of me. He was like, I just want to say thank you, because I was in a place where I was dehumanized so much, and you actually treated me like a human being. So I'm like, look, that was 2012, and the fact that it affected him in that way. But that's the one thing that I didn't see in Portland, is that when I got off the Amtrak and I saw unhoused individuals, I'm thinking, and then you see all these empty hotels. And I look at the sort of these models here in Seattle, where you have a lot of the hotel shelter model, which I think does have some promise. I think that it has some positive effects. And you look at a place like Houston, Texas, where they implemented it, and you have 25,000 people that have been, used this hotel shelter model. I think there is a space for that. So I don't know why Portland isn't implementing that, you know, with more force. I find it interesting, but to see a place where Houston, and once again, nothing is perfect when you're dealing with, this concept of unhoused individuals, but you've seen things that work. So the fact that what you're telling me is that Portland is now deciding to take step backs is sort of galling and disappointing.
Spot on, man. Thanks for the call. And hope you enjoyed your trip to Portland. Tracy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the step back is, you know, part of how our pendulum swings in the city, and it's continued to swing, right? We had an awakening at one point, right, where we were in the streets every night fighting for, you know, the rights of Black people to live, right? Like, I mean, there was a whole Black Lives Matter movement in 2020. We've seen, a huge investment at one point in Portland Street Response to address non-violent crimes in the city, people having potentially maybe, you know, mental health breaks, potentially drug use. And then we saw all of that swing back to the other side. We've seen the political swings in who the mayor is and how the mayor steps in to support community health or not, right? And of course, we learned last week that, our current mayor is not running for re-election. Won't he do it? And I think what we see is this pendulum swing of like wanting to do the right thing and then having our media, right? And I'm not even going to name the media, but if you watch TV at 9 or 10 o'clock, you're likely going to see certain programs continually filling the public mind with Portland is dangerous. This is why these people are the problem, and continually pushing those narratives. So we've got a media structure that continues to push a narrative. We've got our eyes that can see that things are not good. We've got a mayor who has done very little to actually support the community and community health, and has substantially backed big business the people who put him in office, and, you know, is feeling indebted to those people, not running for office, but likely going to find a successor who has the same mentality and the same kind of thinking. The same people in this city that elected Joanne Hardesty then turned around and you know, elected Mingus Maps, right? I mean, we've seen these shifts, right? And we will continue to see the shifts until we all wake up and say, enough. This is enough. I've had enough of it. We need to be moving in one direction and stop this pendulum from swinging so we can make progress. And progress doesn't happen in 2 years, a two-year term of a commissioner, a four-year term of a commissioner, a four-year term of a mayor. It happens through concerted efforts over time to create positive change. And that's something that our electoral politics does not allow for.
Yes, absolutely the case. Yeah, it doesn't happen in a two-year term. It doesn't happen in a four-year term. This is the long haul, listeners. That's what we're in for here. And I think you're along for it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this program. 503-231-8187. Let's go to John. Good morning.
Oh, yeah. Hey, thanks for letting me talk. You know, sure. The right-wingers are looking at what Greg Abbott's got going on in Texas and what DeSantis has got going on in Florida. And then you've got mm-hmm. the right-wing states that are gerrymandering everything. You know, it's guns, migrants, abortion, drugs. Let's just get it all done. Let's have it all going our way. That's what it's about. And you got Fox pushing it all, right? And Trump just lying about everything and pushing all that garbage. The other day, I couldn't believe it, though. Trump said that the rabid abortion is not working. He actually coughed it up and told them that they got it all wrong on abortion. I kind of dug that.
Even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
Yeah. All right. Later.
Hey, thanks for the call, John. Yeah, I think John's right, Tracy. Those three things he talks about: guns, abortion, migrants, and there was a fourth, and it's now escaping me. But what's the thread that draws those all together? The preservation of white male Christian dominance of economic, political, and social life in the United States. That's really what those people can't stomach. 503-231-8187. So what do you see, Tracy? Let's pivot back to Measure 110 here for a moment. Do you think this attempt to roll back some of its provisions will be successful? What do you see happening here?
So I think it'll be close, because I think there are people who have been swayed by the media's effort to demonize poor people, to demonize people who use drugs, to create this narrative that, you know, it hasn't worked, even though it hasn't even been in, you know, it hasn't been resourced and it hasn't been enacted long enough for us to see any positive results. So I think there are people who are fed up and who will say, you know, Fox News is right. You know, K2 News is right. KGW just did an expose on drug use in downtown, right? All of these media efforts to sway the public will be successful. I don't know. Who is going to stay the course and say, actually, we didn't do it right, and we need to continue improving this so we can see some positive impacts. But, you know, I think I, that media machine is very, very powerful, and it also is in support of the people who advertise on their programs, who are Phil Knight, Tim Boyle, right? Like, it all comes full circle, right? The media is also influenced by the very wealthy, as well as the politicians, who are very much influenced by the very wealthy. And so you have this, a lot of distractions out there, right? We can talk about all of the Hunter Bidens in the world. Thank goodness Robbie didn't call to talk about Hunter Biden, because I have no interest in any of that. Hunter Biden is not an elected official. Hunter Biden is not anybody I care about necessarily. I don't know him. He's not, you know, the state senator. I don't know. But
right? We have all of these distractions, and then we have this kind of proliferation of a narrative that continues and continues and continues. And that can be successful for people who are not eyes wide open, who are not understanding the bigger implications and the longer implications of changing something that has literally gone on for 40 years. Do you think 2 years, 3 years of decriminalization and lack of resources towards that effort is going to monumentally change anything when 40 years of criminalization is what we're under, right? The positive change is a long haul. And I think there are people who will just completely, you know, attach themselves to this media narrative that no, the decriminalization didn't work, and will make a ballot choice based on that. And that's unfortunate, and that's why I'm on the radio. That's why I'm here talking to y'all today, because I'm trying to change as many hearts and minds, and Abe and I are trying to create some kind of awareness that these efforts could be successful, but we have to do them thoughtfully, and we have to put the resources behind these efforts to make them successful.
Hear, hear. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your passion and your truth-telling. I think only 15 years ago, Portland still had a tradition of a low-rent city, a progressive city. I wish we could revive that. Portland is one of many deindustrialized wastelands. I saw a video of Berkeley and from just a couple of days ago, and all the stores on University Avenue and San Pablo are closed. This points to the state failure. They're probably taxing food carts and small businesses much too much, and ignoring the super rich. You know, in our tax system, we tax labor and we do not tax wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes wealth is only taxed when it's sold. This is a terrible anomaly. It's a contradiction, just like labor is valued as the source of wealth along with nature, while at the same time more labor is discarded than is created. So we are deindustrialized, and we don't have a state that deals with this at all. It was in the 18th century, Juan Juarez, a French socialist, said capitalism contains crisis and war as rain clouds contain rain. Well, this is very, very true today too, and we have to build a counterculture, and you're doing a great, great work in doing that. So thanks for your energy and passion.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. Thanks for
coming.
Yeah. The beautiful thing about wealth is, you know, when you have it, you can spend it to change the laws, and so you can keep it and get some more. What a great system. 503-231-8187. I want to read a message from, Jer, who wrote into the Facebook page, facebook.com/TMI, saying, good morning. I just wanted to rebut the discussion on Measure 114 that you all were having earlier. Currently, we are required to submit to a background check. We have to fill out a form 4473 with all of our information, including fingerprinting, in order to purchase a firearm. This is already without the implementation of 114. There are no exceptions to this background check. Additionally, the permit to purchase will only affect minority groups. We've seen a large increase in BIPOC gun ownership since 2020, with the biggest group being Black gun owners. While we've seen in states that require a permit, there is a lower overall BIPOC ownership than states that don't require this. The added requirement that law enforcement is required to screen who can and cannot purchase only reinforces who Portlanders and Oregonians really wanted to keep guns away from. And it's not the demographic with the most mass shootings. Ding, ding, ding. Thank you, Jared, for that perspective. That's incredibly valuable. Tracy, you have any comments before we sign off?
Yeah, you know, I, as a Black person, I don't know. I mean, I feel like if there is a standard for getting guns, and the standard means that everyone needs to, you know, do a background check and take a class to show that they are going to be a responsible gun owner and they know how to use that weapon, you know, in the safest way, I don't have a problem with that. And I'm also anti-gun myself. So take that for what it is.
Certainly. But I think Jared's spot on when he suggests that the very people who are fighting Measure 114 also want to keep hands out of or guns out of the hands of black and brown people. I think that's absolutely true. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our program. I want to thank everybody who called in to take part in today's conversation. We will be continuing to track both of these issues, the recriminalization of hard drugs, the effort towards that that's underway, and the status of Measure 114 as it goes before trial in the court of a Trump-appointed federal judge. Tracy, any wise words for us before we sign off?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's this time of year where it's starting to get cold. Please take care of yourselves and others. If you know folks who are in need of shelter, support, please reach out. Reach out to either me or Abe or reach out to Street Roots. Get folks connected. It's going to get cold really quickly. It's getting darker earlier, darker later. Darker earlier and darker earlier in the morning, later in the morning. And just, oh my gosh. But yes, let's take care of each other, please. It's getting cold, so and it'll get real cold really quick and rainy really quick, so let's see what we can do to protect ourselves and each other from the elements.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. This has been Too Much Information, KBOO 90.7 FM. For
you're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Your cheating heart will make you weep.
September 17th is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Hank Williams Sr., one of the finest singer-songwriters this country has ever produced. KBOO Swingin' Country is celebrating this event by dedicating an entire broadcast to the music of Hank Williams. Tune in to KBOO Swingin' Country on Saturday, September 30th from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. for 3 hours of all things Hank Williams considered. We'll have songs sung by Hank, songs written by Hank, and songs about Hank. You don't want to miss it. Once again, that is Saturday, September 30th from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. on KBOO.FM or 90.7 FM in the Portland area. Son of a Gun, we'll have some fun.
The sweetest one, me, oh my.